Hello, and welcome to the U.S. Center for Safe Sports podcast series. At the Center, we are dedicated to making athlete well-being and safety the centerpiece of sport culture. Our podcast will connect individuals to important conversations on getting the best and safest experience out of sports. Get ready to learn valuable information, shareable tips, and helpful resources to keep you engaged in the game. Today, we will be discussing the Safe Sport Code. Our guest today is Michael Henry, Chief Officer for Response and Resolution at the U.S. Center for Safe Sport. Happy listening and welcome, Michael.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Let's start off by helping listeners understand what is the Safe Sport Code.
So the Safe Sport Code is kind of the governing document for what we call the Response and Resolution Office at the center. And generally speaking, the Response and Resolution Office is the department within the center that was set up back in March of 2017 with the center, but also authorized by Congress in February of 2018 as the centralized office for the receipt of investigation of and adjudication of reports of misconduct or abuse that happen within the context of sport. So the Safe Sport Code is essentially the governing document in two different ways. One, it establishes the policies that define what is and is not prohibited conduct. And you know, when you think about it in layman's terms, it's essentially the rules. Don't break the rules. Here's the types of behaviors that would violate the rules. And it covers things from various forms of physical abuse to emotional abuse to different forms of sexual abuse that happen within the context of the Olympic sports. And then it defines the policies and procedures that the Response and Resolution Office and its staff abide by. So it defines the process through which a report can be made, the process through which the center might impose temporary measures if there are ongoing risks to the individuals or the communities in sport, or if and when a violation is found and a sanction imposed based on misconduct, the process through which a respondent, an individual who's been accused of doing something wrong, how they could challenge that through, say, an arbitration hearing. So it's kind of twofold. It's the policies that say here's what not to do, and then the procedures if and when someone is alleged to have engaged in misconduct, and the process through which the center goes through to investigate and ultimately resolve those reports.
Great, thank you for that. And I look forward to kind of diving into this a little bit more. So can you tell me the difference between the code and reporting to law enforcement and the relationship between the two?
Sure. So reporting to law enforcement is kind of a separate and independent function entirely. It's handled by the criminal justice system, which most are familiar with. You know, if you've ever watched CSI or any of the Law and Order types of shows, as I think many have, that goes through the criminal justice system in a court of law. And it's really, when you think about the code versus reporting to law enforcement, is the criminal justice system operates in the same way that the center does with the code, with the penal code. So if something is against the law, if something is considered a crime, if something is considered criminal behavior based on state or federal penal codes, that is what's adjudicated through the criminal justice system. It's ultimately what's assessed by law enforcement when a report is made. Basically, did you violate the law? If a report is made through the center based on someone who participates in the Olympic movement, who allegedly engaged in some sort of behavior that might be considered misconduct, we apply the code to say, did that behavior break the rules? So in the criminal justice sense, it's a report to law enforcement asks whether or not this particular behavior breaks the law. And within the context of the center and the Safe Sport Code, a report to the Response and Resolution Office asks the question, did this individual who participates in the movement, did their behavior break the rules?
Thank you. That's hugely helpful. So then in the context of the code, what does jurisdiction mean? Does it apply to what the code covers or who it covers or both?
That's a great question. And yes, the jurisdiction, when we think about it, is twofold. In the legal context, you think about it as personal jurisdiction and subject matter jurisdiction, which is basically two questions. One, do you have jurisdiction over the individual who's alleged to have engaged in whatever the misconduct is? Basically, do they fall under the code? Are they part of the Olympic community? Are they someone who's even subject to those rules? That's your personal jurisdiction component. And then subject matter jurisdiction is the content of what happened, essentially the behaviors or the conduct that was reported. Is that even conduct that's contemplated or covered by the provisions in the code? So if you're a participant under the code, that's the personal jurisdiction piece. There's kind of a four-prong analysis. And in general, it's anybody who participates meaningfully in the Olympic movement in any sort of capacity. So that includes coaches, athletes, trainers, medical personnel. If they participate in a meaningful way within the Olympic movement, then they likely would fall under the definition of a participant in the code. There's kind of a four-prong analysis that includes employees or board members of national governing bodies or local affiliate organization. It includes individuals who have been authorized, approved, or appointed by a national governing body or a local affiliated organization to interact with, to have regular contact with minor athletes or to have authority over minor athletes. So it's defined in a couple of different ways because people participate within the Olympic movement in a range of different types of capacities. But generally speaking, a participant is someone who participates within the movement in a way that would make them subject to the rules. So that's the personal jurisdiction piece. Are you a participant as defined by the code? And then the subject matter piece is what we referenced earlier, which is what's been reported to the center in terms of alleged misconduct on the part of a participant, is that something contemplated by or covered by the provisions in the code? So subject matter jurisdiction is what allegedly happened, is the alleged behaviors that allegedly occurred, something that's contemplated by the provisions in the code. So would it fall under the definition of a form of physical or emotional abuse? Would it constitute a type of sexual misconduct or sexual abuse as defined by those provisions in the code? So again, you go back to the policies to determine what was reported. Then the investigative process is what's utilized to determine whether or not that behavior, there was sufficient evidence to determine that that behavior occurred in a particular way. And if that behavior or conduct occurred, does it break the rule? So those are kind of the two pieces of the jurisdictional analysis that we look at. Is the person covered under the code, and is what that person did covered under the policies in the code?
So now looking at another layer of the code, can you help our listeners understand the difference between exclusive and discretionary jurisdiction?
Sure. So when you think about the center's subject matter jurisdiction, what types of behaviors are covered by the policies in the Safe Sport Code? It's really broken down into what we call exclusive jurisdiction and discretionary jurisdiction. And the easiest way to think about it is that exclusive jurisdiction, while it covers a range of different types of things that are outlined in the jurisdiction of the center section in the code, exclusive jurisdiction largely covers sexualized forms of misconduct. So any form of non-consensual sexual behaviors in terms of contact, sexual assault, inappropriate sexual communications, all those different forms of sexualized misconduct fall within the center's exclusive jurisdiction. For discretionary jurisdiction, that covers largely non-sexual forms of abuse or misconduct. So think instances of stalking or bullying or hazing or non-sex-based harassment. So when you think about exclusive versus discretionary jurisdiction, exclusive are the types of behaviors that are exclusively covered under the center's jurisdiction, meaning that it's really just the center who can investigate and resolve those types of allegations of misconduct. With discretionary matters, those cases can be and often are investigated and resolved by either the national governing body or the local affiliated organizations or clubs, kind of at the grassroots level. And some of the rationale behind that is that when you've got low severity forms of bullying behaviors between two younger athletes or, hazing instances, many times those cases can actually be most effectively addressed, investigated, and resolved right then and there at the grassroots level by the staff at local clubs or at the NGB level, and don't necessarily need to be nationalized to the center. Whereas sexualized forms of misconduct usually require a higher degree of experience and expertise in order to effectively investigate and resolve them, which is why the center takes all forms of sexual misconduct, whereas forms of physical or emotional misconduct can be often effectively handled at the local level. There are instances, however, when the center can take jurisdiction over a discretionary matter, and those usually involve either a conflict of interest, either at the local level or the national governing body level, and or if the allegations are particularly severe. So think of bullying behaviors that result in some sort of severe injury, hazing instances that resulted in severe injury or even death. Those instances would likely be taken on a discretionary basis by the center's investigative staff.
That's very helpful. Thank you for bringing a lot more clarity to those components. And now let's take a step back and let's talk about why the code exists. What is its purpose?
So the code's purpose is really to standardize two critical pieces, which is what are the policies in terms of expectations for behavior and conduct that all individuals who participate in the Olympic movement need to abide by. So, you know, refraining from engaging anything that could be sexually abusive, physically abusive, or emotionally abusive, particularly geared towards protecting athletes who participate in sport. But it applies across the board in terms of providing a baseline for these are the types of conduct and behavior that will not be tolerated within the Olympic movement. And then the secondary piece is establishing what that process and those procedures are for the investigation and resolution of allegations of misconduct for those individuals who participate in the movement. So it's twofold: establish the rules and then establish the process through which violations of the rules are processed and resolved.
All right, thank you so much for that. So then, following with that, can you tell me a little bit about how the code interacts with the minor athlete abuse prevention policies and how the two exist in keeping athletes safe from abuse in sport?
Sure. So they serve kind of two separate functions. We'll start with the minor athlete abuse prevention policies. Those are what we call proactive policies. They're designed to facilitate circumstances and or prevent certain circumstances from taking place that would expose minor athletes to particular types of risks. So they really are designed to reduce the risk that minor athletes are ever put in a position where there could be instances of abuse or misconduct perpetuated against them. The code basically says if and when there are behaviors that occur that constitute abuse or misconduct, these are the rules that say this is and is not okay, and these are the policies and procedures that define how those alleged incidents would be handled, investigated, and ultimately resolved. So when you think about the minor athlete abuse prevention policies, they are proactive standards to try to prevent riskier circumstances from ever taking place so that we can eliminate abuse from ever happening in the first place, provides required components for training to ensure that everybody who participates in the movement, every adult who participates in the movement and who fit for certain criteria are effectively trained in spotting abuse. They know what to look for. They know how to avoid it. And then policies to prevent circumstances that would pose particular types of risk to athletes. And then the code defines what would constitute misconduct or abuse if it were to occur and the process and policies and procedures through which that would be addressed.
Thank you. That's hugely helpful in understanding how each one of these things play an important role in youth sports. So then let's steer back to the code and let's focus a little bit on the policy and procedures. So can you talk about how the policy section of the code and the procedure section of the code are different?
So the first portion of the code is the policies. And so it lays out the definitions that permeate each of those policies. So that includes consent definition, legal capacity, incapacitation, which specifically relate to some of the sexualized forms of misconduct and or intimate relationships where a power imbalance exists, et cetera. And then you have the prohibited conduct section that actually lays out what are different types of behaviors that would be considered prohibited conduct. So that's instances like various forms of child abuse, sexual misconduct, gender-based discrimination or harassment, sexual exploitation. And then you get into instances of emotional and physical misconduct. So various forms of bullying, hazing, other inappropriate instances that would be physically or emotionally abusive within the context of sport. And then you get into the procedures, which is, it lays out the requirements for mandatory reporting of certain types of incidents, including sexual misconduct or child abuse. It tracks the procedures and process through which a report can be made to the center, how that's then worked through the process in terms of conducting preliminary inquiry, what's the standard of proof, all the way down to how the investigative process plays out, what the specific opportunities, options are for parties who participate in that, how the center effectuates temporary measures, what the various types of sanctions that the center can impose are, and how they're contemplated as part of the response and resolution process. And then separately, if and when a decision is rendered on a particular respondent and a sanction imposed, that respondent has the opportunity to request an arbitration hearing before an independent arbitrator. So the last section of the code outlines the rules, process, and policies regarding how that actual hearing itself plays out, given that it's technically effectuated through an independent arbitration body.
Great. Thank you for clarifying. So then I know there have been multiple versions of the code over time. Can you help our listeners understand a little bit more about the different versions and what has been adapted or changed in those different iterations?
Sure. So the first code was issued when the center first opens its door in March of 2017. And each subsequent year, right around the same time, on essentially an annual cycle, the center consistently is looking at ways to improve, clarify, the provisions, policies, and process that's defined within the code. So as the center first started out and as it's evolved over the last several years, it's figured out, particular areas that could be improved, particular provisions that needed to be added to cover certain types of more novel circumstances, or to tweak certain aspects of the process to ensure that it was clear, fair, and that we were providing, folks who were looking for information about what the process is and isn't and what's included in it, making sure that was clearly defined throughout. So essentially making any sort of augmentations, clarifications, and improvements to the code over time.
So now looking at the new 2020 SafeSport code, can you walk us through some of those updates?
Sure. So, there was a couple of clarifications that we wanted to make in the 2020 code, just to make sure certain provisions were crystal clear as to what all they covered. One of the first one was the actual participant definition itself. One of the changes that we made was to ensure that it included expressly employees as well as board members of national governing bodies or local affiliate organizations or the USOPC, to ensure that those were participants beholden to the provisions in the code, just like the rest of the participants within the movement. One of the other things we did was clarified the aiding and abetting provision. Aiding and abetting is a certain type of prohibited conduct wherein it prohibits individuals from essentially encouraging or facilitating or promoting the commission of prohibited conduct. And the way that it had previously been defined, it really related directly to an act. And there are other types of instances where one can kind of facilitate the commission of prohibited conduct, not by doing anything specifically, but by failing to do something over which they had control. So making sure that we clarify that language does include all the different instances or circumstances wherein one could engage in aiding and abetting. So that was one of the updates that we made. And then we also made a clarification to the reporting requirements, namely making sure that, individuals knew that they didn't have to know that, say sexual misconduct had occurred, they simply had to reasonably suspect it, which actually tracks some of the statutory language in terms of reasonably suspect child abuse, rather than you don't have to know that something is occurring. You don't have any obligation to investigate it, making sure that folks were clear that really, if you reasonably suspect sexual misconduct, that you had to immediately report that to the center. So clarifying some of those provisions, not new provisions that we added, but more clarifications to ensure that it meant exactly what the intent was.
Thank you. That helps to have a snapshot on some of those updates. So then are there any other noteworthy sections that have been updated that you'd like to help our listeners understand better?
Yeah, there was a couple of new provisions that we actually did add. One of them was a new provision called willful tolerance. And previously, much of these types of circumstances would have been covered under the aiding and abetting provision. But what we found is that there was an instance that wasn't expressly covered under the code, which is not necessarily aiding and abetting the commission of prohibited conduct, but really knowing that it was happening and not doing anything about it. So that provision is specific to adult participants who have a power imbalance or a position of authority. So think of an instance where an adult coach supervising minor athletes as part of a team knew that there was a hazing ritual that happened every year that could potentially put individuals at risk or even result in harm. They didn't do anything about it. They didn't facilitate it. They didn't even promote it. They just knew it was happening. And particularly when you're in a position of authority, we want to make sure that it is a clear expectation of people who participate in the movement, particularly coaches and trainers and those with positions of authority, that they know they do have an obligation to step in if they know that prohibited conduct is occurring, like that example. So that new provision makes certain that not only is that expectation clear for individuals in terms of it being a standard of behavior, but also that it would be applied as a type of policy violation if coaches were found to have known about these types of instances and done nothing to stop it. And then lastly, a new change to the code is actually more procedure-based, which was, as I mentioned earlier, at the end of the response resolution process, respondents always have an opportunity to challenge the center's decision via an arbitration hearing. One of the pieces of feedback that we had heard over the course of the year was that per the code, there was a 5 business day window after the issuance of a decision to request that arbitration hearing. And what we were finding is that respondents really wanted to have a little bit more time either to seek out legal counsel if they so choose, or to spend a little bit more time going through what's often a 100-plus page investigation report and notice of decision before determining whether or not they really wanted to proceed to an arbitration hearing. So that has been expanded from 5 business days to a 10-business day window during which a respondent could request an arbitration hearing following a decision.
So now that we understand more about the code, its purpose, and some of the components, I'd like to look at it from a few different perspectives. So if I'm a coach, club owner, or parent, what do I need to know? How would this apply to my everyday life?
If you're a club owner or a parent or a coach, what you need to know is that the code exists, that it defines what's acceptable types of behaviors and conduct for people who participate in the movement in any capacity. And so that you know what the standards are for acceptable behaviors. Many of those are going to be commonsensical. If you're an adult coach, don't engage in intimate relationships with your athletes. Most everybody knows that. They don't need necessarily a rule to tell them that. But in other instances, like various forms of emotional or physical abuse, it's basically understanding that this lays out the standards for how we interact with each other, regardless of the role that we play. In terms of how it'll affect your everyday life, if you understand what the policies are, then you can make sure that your behavior abides by them, and also spot if and when others' behaviors doesn't comport with the standards set out in the code. What that means is that if you experience certain types of behaviors or other forms of misconduct, that you know that it's against the rules and that it can be reported, and that ultimately there's a process through which those allegations could be investigated and resolved in order to ensure that they don't happen again.
Okay, so then if someone needs to make a report or has made a report regarding a code violation, what would you want them to know and understand?
So there's a number of different procedural pieces of the code that help someone understand, if I make a report, what is this going to look like? Those provisions deal with privacy and confidentiality, what the reporting process looks like, the circumstances in which the center would impose temporary measures. And then, what we would always encourage particularly claimants to understand is that the reporting process is also an opportunity to get information and to ask questions about that process. So while the code lays out, here's what a report would look like, here's how it would be handled throughout the response and resolution process, claimants should know that they can still make their own decision about the who, what, when, where of how they participate in that process. Reports can be made confidentially, they can be made anonymously, and there's different ways per the code how those types of circumstances are handled. In some instances, the center may not be able to proceed on an anonymous report. In other instances, it may. And in some instances, the center may not be able to proceed with a formal investigation if a claimant doesn't wish to participate in that investigative process. In other instances, there may be independent corroborating evidence where it could. So all those questions are answered in the SafeSport code and also could be answered if someone wishes to make a report, either online or over the phone. So what I would want claimants to understand is that information is all contained within the code in terms of what the rules are, so that they can assess, is this thing that happened to me against the rules? And then to understand what that process looks like if and when they were to make a report. And if they have any questions about that, always to feel free to reach out to the center and talk with our staff. They can do that confidentially and in a way that doesn't obligate them to do anything else in that process. They can make those decisions for themselves.
Looking at it from the other side, from the perspective of a respondent, what would you want them to know and understand?
So a respondent is the term that we use in the code for someone who's been accused of engaging in some form of misconduct. And while certainly no one would want to find themselves in the position of being accused of having done something wrong, like we discussed earlier, one, the code lays out what's considered prohibited conduct. So it outlines the standards for behaviors and how we interact with each other to ensure people don't break the rules. And the other piece would be, for respondents, the code also lays out the process through which those accusations or allegations are investigated and ultimately resolved. What I would want respondents to know is that the code lays out a thorough, comprehensive, fair process for investigating allegations. Not all allegations are necessarily true, or not all behaviors necessarily violate the rules, but that's what's played out through this investigative process. So the code lays out what that process looks like, answers some questions as to what to expect, and then if someone finds themselves in a position of being a respondent, they can look to the code for understanding how we're going to get from point A to point B. We have a report of alleged misconduct. How are we going to investigate and ultimately determine what occurred and whether or not what occurred violates the rules?
Thank you for helping us understand the code through those different perspectives and for helping explain the code overall and how it applies and its purpose. Now that you know about the SafeSport code, if you know of or suspect abuse or misconduct, report it to www.uscenterforsafesport.org. You can report anywhere, anytime on our 24/7 portal. If you have confidential or anonymous questions and want support for yourself or someone else, contact the SafeSport Helpline through the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network at www.safesporthelpline.org. Thanks for listening and tune in next time.